You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Bannick.
What happens to development when the money tightens, politics hardens, and trust begins to fray? A decade ago, optimism shaped the global agenda. The Paris Agreement on climate, the Addis Ababa Agenda on financing for development, the 2030 Agenda and its 17 Sustainable Development Goals. It felt like a new era of shared purpose. Now, fast forward to today, and that picture looks very different. Aid budgets are shrinking, multilateralism is under strain, and a question many of us keep coming back to is this: does aid still deliver what it promises? And if so, for whom? Is aid still a catalyst for global public goods, a tool for soft power, or something in between? And if the biggest donors pull back, who steps up? Coalitions of mid-sized countries, Gulf funds, southern providers, or entirely new actors rewriting the rules? My guest today is someone who has spent years studying these questions. Nilima Gulrajani is a principal research fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's one of the most thoughtful voices on how aid is organized and how it can be reimagined for a changing world. We begin with a deceptively simple question. How effective has aid really been? From there, we turn to the present. Aid agencies are grappling with a broken social contract at home. And across the global south, partners face tighter budgets and rising skepticism. So what can still be fixed? Where can reform, perhaps not reinvention, actually move the needle? We talk about how to pursue effectiveness, why smarter debt policy might matter more than another dollar of aid, and how bilateral tools and multilateral muscle can work together when global problems such as climate, conflict, and pandemics refuse to stop at borders. I hope you're still enjoying Season 6 of In Pursuit of Development. Please continue to share your feedback and help others discover the show. This is Dan Bannick, and you are listening to In Pursuit of Development. Nilima, I've been following your work for many, many years, and we've been friends on social media for many years, but finally we get to chat. Welcome on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I'm really pleased to be here, and I too have been following your work over the years as well. So great to have this virtual meeting.
There's one thing that a lot of my students and colleagues, particularly in Asia and Africa, often question, and that is, how effective has aid been in promoting development? And there's a whole body of literature on this. So I'm going to put you a bit on the spot because I haven't really sent you any questions. I don't have any. But having worked on aid for all of these years, how would you characterize the contribution of development aid in promoting development around the world?
So I guess I would start by saying we have to recognize that aid is but a small financial flow of overall total resource flows or financial flows to the global south. So it is still nonetheless a significant amount. In 2023, we had $223 billion provided as official development assistance, which is the concessional or grant-based finance that flows from the global north to the global south. In terms of the contributions of aid per se, I think one can measure that quite succinctly if one looks particularly at sectors like health, infectious diseases in particular, river blindness, the tremendous success we've had on polio. I mean, there are a variety of health outcomes that I think can be directly attributed to the investments that have been provided in global public health. But I actually think even beyond that, there is something about aid that it has allowed a diplomatic relationship to form in places where sometimes that may have been difficult to have had. It's allowed for relationships to be built, for soft power to be exercised in a way that has been helpful in many cases, not always, and we can talk about some of the harms. But I do think that it is an important form of global cooperation. It lubricates relationships. And I think the question I have is how it can lubricate those relationships better, particularly at this moment of geopolitical anxiety and fragmentation.
I think some of the questions that people who are skeptical of aid ask these days is who is actually benefiting from aid? And this alludes to what you just said about foreign policy. You know, sometimes one gets the impression that aid is more important for us in the global north. It is an important part of cultivating soft power. It is an important way of getting a seat at the table where the big powers are, at least for a country like Norway. It is important to show that we are humanitarian superpowers. We punch above our weight. Then the question really is the extent to which aid is more for us and not so much for recipient countries.
Yeah, I think you have to acknowledge that the creation of official development assistance would only have ever happened if it served the countries that were providing that assistance. Otherwise, there would be no rational sense for a state to provide assistance. So I think the starting point for aid has to come from somewhere where at least there's a mutual interest. There's a sense that by providing this, I even get, the kind of the fuzzy feelings of being generous, even if it's that, right? That is a form of benefit, if you will. And, you can read texts like The Gift, going back to kind of show how giving, has always involved a return to the giver, as well as a gift to the receiver. So I think in terms of who benefits from aid, there will always be a return to the gifter, to the provider. That being said, I don't think we can completely disregard the fact that, particularly in a world where our interdependencies are so great, that there is a collective that there can be, for sure, a collective benefit from that provision. And I definitely feel we're in a moment where we are talking about those collective benefits and how we can maximize them in terms of their quantum, but also their scope and their reach globally.
So the world looks pretty different today. 10 years ago, it was much more optimistic, Nilima. We had the Paris Agreement, we had the Addis Ababa Financing Agreement, we had the 2030 Agenda. And today, as we speak, the UN General Assembly is meeting. It is a different world. How would you characterize the aid landscape? Is it all bad? Are there some promising things in the horizon? How would you put it?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about it as there's a broken social contract around aid at the minute. I think, there is really a sense in which governments feel that the aid budget is vulnerable due to, let's say, waning public opinion amongst taxpayers. And we can talk a bit about the reasons for that. And I think in the global south, you see a tremendous amount of critique and questioning about the value of the flow, the hypocrisy of the flow in terms of, policies that are non-aid policies that seem to contradict the aid mission. So, the way I would characterize this moment is it is vulnerable, I would say. At the same token, I think this moment can also provide an opportunity for a rethink and a reset, let's say. I'm not so naive to think that we can completely destroy the institutions and modalities that we have today and get something better at this particular moment. I think that's wishful thinking. But I do think within the context of the institutions and financing modalities we do have the possibility of engaging in reform to build something better. And so I think it's vulnerable, but I think they're promising opportunities at this moment as well.
In some of my recent interactions with aid agencies and officials, I've been making a three-point argument, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. One is I'm interested in knowing who's going to really step up. With the Americans, reducing their flows, and there's still a lot of uncertainty as to whatever they have going on, how it'll be used, and who will it be directed towards. I'm talking about USAID, if it'll live on in any way. So who's going to step up and And, you know, I keep wondering, is the EU up to it? Is it, you know, some of our countries here, the Scandinavians, we are generous, but we are not big economies like the US. So obviously we need a huge, you know, new contribution. Somebody has to step up. So that's the first one. The second has to do with, maybe we shouldn't think about all the bad stuff that, you know, we can prioritize differently. There are lots of opportunities that could arise from prioritization within aid recipient countries, but also among donors. And so the second point is twofold in the sense that, you know, my favorite country, Malawi, which is heavily aid reliant, and they're just going to have an election in 2 days. I'm really worried as to how a country like Malawi is going to finance its budget without the US. But there are lots of opportunities and one can't just give up. At the same time, we've had an election in Norway and there's going to be another coalition government. We don't know what these priorities are going to be. So that's the second bit. The third one is, I think, Nilima, and I'd like to hear your thoughts too on this, is that we really in the West and the global North may need to adopt a new strategy to collaborate with the global South. I'm talking about the major global South actors. Maybe it's not just India and China and Brazil. It has to also be the UAE, maybe Indonesia. You know, there are lots and lots of other players on the African continent, in Asia, Latin America, that we may well have to you know, institutionalize new ties with rather than just, you know, rely on what we were doing. And business as usual is just not going to do it. So those were my sort of 2 cents worth on how I see it at the moment.
I mean, those are all interrelated, and I might try and tie them, the answer together. I think in terms of the answer to the question, who will step up? I think, you know, I think what we're seeing is there's no one who really wants to fill the shoes the UK, that the US has left vacant. And I think what you're seeing, though, is a different kind of prioritization, to kind of answer your second question. I think you're seeing a real desire to think more seriously about how we bring new actors into the system. And they're hardly new these days. But, you know, thinking about what's gone wrong with private capital mobilization and how we can do a better job and remove the barriers to that is one area where I think the Northern donor ecosystem is thinking. I think there are new strategies that they're adopting as well. So to answer your third point, a lot of interest in thinking about how to work better with Gulf donors, donors in Southeast Asia, looking beyond the BRICS to your point. So, you know, for those who lament the fact that no one has stepped up as I have been over the last few months, to be honest, expecting maybe some sort of coalition to come together around, certainly around the short-term effects, because I think the short-term collateral damage of the withdrawal, the way it was done, particularly in global health and humanitarian, is so significant that I would have expected a stronger coalition to have emerged quite soon, at least until such time as, you know, alternative policy or financial could have been put in place in many countries extremely dependent on USAID funding. I think, you know, the different prioritization that we're seeing is a very live debate, not only in terms of different sources of capital, but what do we do in a world where we have less money? Yeah. How do we think about that? And it's very live in the context of UN80, because the truth is the financial hit that the UN is taking as a result of both arrears and late payments, but on top of the cessation of payments and the withdrawal of many donors, not just the US, of voluntary contributions, is really kind of, you know, there's a lot of soul searching happening in the UN system. So I think how we prioritize is very critical. And then also how we think about resources that may come from the domestic treasuries of countries like Malawi, like Nigeria, like Tanzania and Ethiopia, where there's, you know, a reexamination of the kinds of dependencies that aid created, and whether, you know, taxation, tackling, you know, illicit financial flow leakage, a variety of alternative mechanisms that may exist to try and substitute for the loss of funds triggered by the US and other donors, I should say, withdrawal. Yeah, so I think all three of your points kind of blend into this question of what's happening at this particular moment and the options that many in the ecosystem are now considering.
But, you know, if I were to answer my own points or be critical, as much as I am hopeful
that there will be somebody or some group of countries that will step up. In the short term, I don't see that happening because budgets are constrained. There are lots of political parties that are very hostile to foreign aid. So I don't see that happening. On the last point, you know, in terms of new partnerships with China or other Global South actors, there's also political challenges at home in terms of China bashing, being suspicious of China's motives. So on the first and third points, I'm not very optimistic in the short term. Where I do see a ray of hope, Nilima, is within countries where governments were relying on aid. They almost took it for granted. Health and education were going to be funded by donors. We can focus on other stuff. We can borrow for expensive infrastructure projects, and these so-called soft areas would be funded by foreign donors. I hope that within these countries, there will be a new kind of priority, new realization that we have to use taxpayer money to fund these things. And maybe that'll lead to greater awareness, accountability, efficiency, I don't know. And in terms of the donors changing their, you know, modus of operation, I hope, I don't expect it, but I hope there will be much more of a focus on what really works, effectiveness, etc. Which brings me to something I read. I've read a lot of your work. I think there was a piece you and Dan Hoenig, one of my favorite guests on the show, you wrote in 2017, if I remember correctly, a paper on, you know, how can we expect these donors to follow up on what they had promised in terms of aligning their policies and harmonizing aid policies. We see that in the field, at least I see it in Africa, there's often a replication. Every donor wants credit for whatever they are doing. There has to be clear attribution. You have to write these fancy reports. So talking about prioritization within donor agencies, Nilima, how do you see that happening? Do you think there will be greater focus on aid effectiveness, making sure there are good evaluations, cutting things out? By the way, politicians don't like to often cut. They want to just pile on. You know, how do you think that's going to play out?
So I think we are going to definitely see a desire to get more bang for every dollar, every buck. So that there's no question. I do hope, though, that we won't get into bean counting, because that sort of seems to defeat the purpose, particularly if you think about the problems of underdevelopment as having deeper structural roots than just a financial gap. I do think that donors themselves need to be thinking about how they can marshal their wider policy toolkit beyond their aid budget to really think about how they tackle those sources of underdevelopment. And for example, you can think about debt and how we desperately need some sort of way to manage debt, which is not about a spend. It's about a policy shift in terms of how we treat creditors. You know, in some countries, you know, creditors that are based at home who will take a hit, which, you know, will affect their market position. And there is a cost to that. And, you know, it may be that that cost is far greater than even the small amounts of aid circulating in the system. So, you know, a large part of the dialogues that we're convening at ODI, so I sit at ODI as a global think tank based in the UK, and convening this series that is really thinking about a new role for Northern bilateral donors in this world that we sort of tongue-in-cheek called a post-aid world early in 2024, not really expecting that the post-aid world would actually materialize so soon after we launched the series. But essentially, in that series, we've been convening bilateral donors with a rotating cast of think tankers and researchers and activists. And we've come up with a few ways in which we think the evolution of the Northern bilateral donor landscape will move. And one of them is in the context of really engaging with the drivers of structural transformation. And, you know, I will say that when we started having that conversation in October 2024, there was a lot more optimism about the ability to move in that direction. I think since the cuts, the US and the election of Donald Trump in the US, there's perhaps less sense of ambition of what's possible given the fragmentation we see in terms of the global powers and the ability to generate consensus amongst, let's say, member states and particularly the more powerful member states. And so, but I do think we need to think about get beyond this bean counting point and really think about, aid in conjunction with a much wider policy toolkit for really tackling those structural drivers of inequality in the world today.
I absolutely agree with you on the debt issue. Thanks for mentioning that. I think that could be something really important for policymakers to focus on going forward. But, Nilima, I'm really worried about UN financing and somebody we know, Ronnie Patz, who's been doing great work on it. I was chatting with him and it is just mind-boggling how little money some of these agencies have now. I'm told that key UN officials don't have travel money. Things are really changing very fast. When the US pulls out of the 2030 agenda, no support for the SDGs, I just don't know how this is going to play out. And so one criticism that I've been hearing over the years is against the sort of the northern donors is that we have been allocating more and more resources towards the multilateral system. And we have not been prioritizing bilateral projects, which also means that we are losing ownership. We can't enforce our values. We can't follow up. We don't have the expertise, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of the money is just disappearing into this UN system or through the bank. How do you think that's going to work out going forward? Do you think that may change, that in terms of prioritization, the donors would go back to bilateral projects more because the UN, funds are being cut out? Would they maintain current levels? And what would be the potential implications of that change? Because multilateralism, well, it has been in crisis for decades, but it seems to be more of a crisis now than ever before.
So, yes, I think multilateralism is in a very dire, dire situation. I mean, I do think we have to distinguish between the Global Vertical Funds, the World Bank, and the UN, because I think each of those are in very different financial positions. And I think, in particular, the segment of that system that is really in crisis is the UN system. And so, again, just last week, we were hosting a dialogue on UN reform and what its value proposition might be and what the role of the largest funders should be in terms of resuscitating that system. So I think, where I see this going, I think a lot of people have talked about how we will see a resurgence of bilateral aid just because geopolitical context at the minute is one that seems to desire more control over funding, to allocate much more in light of national interests. And really, a sense that the multilateral system has, very little visibility for donors, very little accountability for them, and it's not been delivering. And so I think that's the direction of the trajectory, potentially. I think it's problematic, and I actually think we need to be thinking the reverse. I think thinking about the potential end of bilateralism and a rejuvenation of a multilateral system, particularly on the UN side, is something that we ambitiously target. And the reason for that are a couple. The first is we are tackling global challenges more than we have ever before, whether it be climate, whether it be conflict, infectious diseases. Those are challenges that need more than one state's cooperation with one other state's, which essentially is what bilateral channels is. We do need at least regional cooperation if we can't have true mega multilateralism. And I think we would be ignoring one of the more salient development challenges and one of the development challenges that are, that require institutions to be able to deliver on outcome. They require norms and standards to be agreed in order to deliver on. And that is only a role that I think multilateral / regional institutions can play. Conversely, I think taxpayers will soon realize that if we allocate all of our funds through bilateral channels at this moment, or the most, and I should say about 60% currently goes to bilateral, 40% to multilateral, And within that multilateral pool, also to say that many of those funds are earmarked for certain regions and sectors. And so that actually is considered a form of bilateral assistance or multi-buy aid as well. So these donors do actually have a lot of control over their multilateral financing, if you think about how much is tightly earmarked in particular. So I think going back to this point about, the end of bilateral aid is something that I think we should be ambitiously shooting for, because I don't think we're going to be able to deliver on the challenges the world faces at the minute. That being said, I do think we have to recognize that we do need financing for diplomatic relationship building. And I think, what I'm trying to say there is the end of bilateral aid is more the end of calling that bilateral aid, because it's not aid. Let's just be frank. It is financing that is meant to lubricate relationship building, trade deals, various policy demands that we might have of other countries. And that is important function that diplomacy and diplomats play, and that needs to be funded. But I think if we're truly thinking about aid as we define it in official development as official development assistance, the risk is that what we're calling bilateral aid is no longer meeting that definition. And we only have to look at how much aid was spent in the last few years on refugee costs, on Ukraine, and has spent at home in countries, in northern giving countries themselves, as opposed to a country programmable aid in the global south, to say this flow may not be fit for purpose as we've currently designed it when we put it in the hands of bilateral governments. And so I think we need to start thinking radically about new modalities, and I think we need to invest. And I mean by invest political capital more than I mean more financial capital in really rethinking the multilateral architecture and the multilateral system, and in particular, the UN development system.
I'm not so sure that we are going to return to sort of pre-2025 levels in terms of UN financing. And more so because in many parts of our world, there's a lot of suspicion on how effective UN agencies have been in delivering development, replication, overlap, inefficiencies. This feeling that the UN really needs to be reformed, but the UN reform process has been talked about for, I don't know, ever since it was, I suppose, established. And, you can say a lot about UN reform, but I don't think it seems to be satisfying our appetites. I mean, there's a need for maybe major structural change, not just putting five agencies or merging everything into five. So that's why I think maybe, as much as you may wish for bilateral aid to end, maybe it's going to continue. But on that note, Nilima, I wonder what you think about the Chinese approach, because much of what China does is often couched as solidarity and talking to entire continents, but the essence is still a focus on bilateralism. And over the years, I've seen the Chinese providing increased support to UN institutions, including UNDESA. More Chinese high-level officials are now in the UN, but it's still bilateralism that trumps most of its projects. So whether it's aid or investments, however, I mean, obviously you can't talk about Chinese aid as in ODA, but nonetheless, Chinese aid and investment, say on the African continent, seems to be still very bilateral in nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The Chinese model, definitely has delivered. It's delivered the goods for China, first and foremost, and it has provided an exemplar for many other states in the global south to really challenge northern aid provision, its normative framework, its effectiveness, its politicization. So I think, what do I think about it? So I think it is more bilateral than multilateral, no doubt. And I think there are good reasons for that. We started with the point that all aid has to be provided in, at some level, a national benefit or a national interest, right? So I think what I was going with the end of the bilateral aid argument is that can also be in the national interest. That there is the possibility for multilateralism to be in the national interest. And you only have to think about how China has set up the AIIB as an alternative multilateral institution to the traditional MDBs to see how it also thinks of multilateralism as lying in its national interest. Yes, its financing to the UN is strategic. It is actually more core than voluntary. China does very little voluntary financing to the UN. So it is mainly providing core, sorry, earmarked voluntary. It provides a lot of good quality UN financing, let's say, compared to many of the other donors. But it is also strategically using that financing to think about how it staffs particular institutions at the highest level. That alone should have the US wondering what it's doing in terms of the pullout and really give it pause. So, recognizing that, this financing sits within the geopolitical context, a complete withdrawal of the US from the UN system seems to be giving a kind of carte blanche to China to step in. So I think, the Chinese approach is valuable. It has been multilateral and it has delivered for Chinese national interests, is I think for me an example of why we need to think about the multilateral system as a channel for the national interest, but also a channel for delivering, those important global public goods that we need.
So a few years ago, I think you wrote a piece on emergent strategies of development power. As donors, what is it that they really seek? I mean, are they reluctant, as I think you portrayed Germany to be, or omnipresent as France is, or realist as the UK is, or virtuous as Sweden or the Nordics perhaps are? I think you were recommending several strategies for donors to achieve smart development power. If you can please tell my listeners, what is it that these strategies, these donors should strive for that kind of smart, effective development power? I suppose one thing would be aid effectiveness, evidence-based, listening to the voices rather than just preaching. But there may be other things. And related to these recommendations, Nilima, I wonder how you see South-South cooperation going forward, particularly whether we could see emergent strategies where the Global North and the Global South are actually entering into strategic partnerships. One example would be Norway financing an infrastructure project that a Chinese company would build on the African continent.
Yeah. So let me start with the smart development power. So here the idea is that smart development power would be the intelligent use of the instruments, the entire toolkit available to the bilateral donor community beyond just aid. So that includes, the use of their financing to the multilateral system, which is goes beyond aid in many cases, the use of trade policy and other forms of official financial flows, and thinking about, their economic footprint, thinking about their economic cooperation, global public goods, and how they invest in global public goods. And so I think for me, it's recognizing that at this moment, to copy a Chinese model, given the quantum that Northern donors have, is unrealistic. And so, and also given the kind of some of the normative aims and ambitions of many of the countries is also, not likely to be, in akin to the Chinese model. And so how do we think about what a potential Northern strategy might be? And here the idea of smart development power comes to play. And here the argument is that if you can show consistency and reliability, with Global South partners, you can grow, your influence, so that solidarity can become a form of national interest. It's also recognizing that the quantum of aid may be insufficient for cultivating that power and that maybe the quality of that aid may be more significant in doing that. Really thinking about your offer as a bilateral in terms of your technical competency, the kinds of long-term investments that you can make, the clarity of what you're trying to achieve, all those, the quality of what you do are also sources of influence and credibility. Not to underestimate well, we talked a bit about this, the multilateral engagement that you have, that membership and collaboration and investment in the multilateral system are also key levers for influence. And really, that thinking about how impact first or delivering on impact first may actually be a source of your influence. So impact first, influence second. So for me, that is what smart development power is, and that is something that I think the bilateral donor community may want to think about in this era, acknowledging that that power comes from much more than just the aid lever. But, aid is one part of it. It's not the only part of it. But thinking about how these tools work together. You had a second question about South-South cooperation.
Let me just add in a bit here. I think everything you said about smart development power is what I think China has in part achieved already. this is my take, you may disagree. I think China is far better at disseminating, communicating with recipient or partner countries, that it is acting to promote solidarity, that it is not just giving, but also wants something back. So there's reciprocity that creates respect. I think that some of these things, I'm not saying that China is perfect in every way, but I don't think we've been very good at communicating that. We often have said, oh, here's some money. We don't want anything from you. Your goods are not good enough to be imported to our countries. And China, even though China may agree with us, it never says it publicly. So it just makes recipient partner countries, it creates better goodwill, I would say.
I think that's right. I completely agree with you on China, that China has been able to use the language of solidarity, in some case real, in some case maybe less real, to its advantage, that it has based that cooperation in norms like sovereign equality and reciprocity and mutual benefit. I think the question I have is whether that remains. So I think there are common values that all states want, and I think respect, you know, mutual benefits and a sense of equality between states is definitely this common framework that the northern donor communities need to do better at articulating. And I think we haven't done a good job of that. But I guess the question I have is whether the Chinese model is, first of all, really the Chinese model in the way that those values are they substantiated or not? But secondly, if you can't achieve that in quantum, given the kind of the size of Chinese investment and the economy, I think we need to think about alternative levers for cultivating or showing up with the values of solidarity, reciprocity, and sovereignty. So I think, you know, things like structural transformation, because if you think about, has China really transformed the economy of Malawi in a good way, in a way that has advanced, you know, equity, has advanced, you know, democratic norms, advanced the cause for women, right? I think you may question that. And I think there may be ways in which northern donor institutions can anchor their cooperation, the full policy toolkit of their development cooperation in these countries, and truly demonstrate the achievement of the values of equity, solidarity, respect, and mutual benefit. And I think that's where they need to be aiming at this point.
So, you know, China and Malawi never had anything on democracy, on gender, on all of these aspects that we were concerned with. China was building infrastructure. And so to answer your question, yes, China has transformed the urban landscape terms of roads and bridges and hotels and football stadiums and presidential villas, parliament building. So you have that, which the West wasn't doing. So in many countries like Malawi, Nilima, I see a clear distinction, a division of labor. Northern donors are doing certain things. China is doing infrastructure.
Yeah.
China says, you know, this was never our goal. So, you know, that's not something we've been doing. But this is what we're doing, and we're doing it well, and we finish things on time, and we're giving you money and the expertise to build roads that the West is not providing you with. And infrastructure is what a lot of these countries are looking for. Since we're running out of time, I just wanted to ask you, do you think the Global South, this grouping of BRICS and the new BRICS and the G20, where many of these Global South actors have been very influential this last 4 years. Do you think the Global South increasingly will articulate a different model of development, of aid, and the South-South cooperation will be scaled up that could potentially match or exceed what is coming from the Global North?
I truly hope so. My expectation is that there will be some sort of scaling up of South-South cooperation. And, you know, certainly in the context of infrastructure development, which we were talking about earlier, I can expect that. I think the kind of the northern donor ecosystem is going to be thinking quite carefully about how to partner with southern providers. I think I expect triangular cooperation in particular to grow as a modality. And I think, you know, the hope I have is that that can lead to a bit more rebalancing in the ecosystem, both in terms of the quantums of financial flows that come from various states. I think we hopefully will get to a point where, you know, all countries recognize their obligation and their interest in investing in a fairer global development system. So I'm hopeful actually that this crisis can be used in such a way that builds that equity and that equitable development system, yeah, for the next generation.
Well, on that optimistic note, thank you very much for coming on my show. It was a great pleasure to see you and to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.